I know, but we mustn't lose hope, ever. She rubbed my back until I settled down, her gliding palm tender and soothing. I tried to recall if my own mother had ever done such a thing when I was sick or upset. I couldn't think of a single instance which made me savor Franny's gentle touch all the more. "Emma, I need to know something," she said, her voice on the edge of a whisper. "You don't really think Theo hurt your friends, do you?" I said nothing in return. Fear kept me silent. I couldn't take back what I'd told the police, not then. Yes, Theo was in a lot of trouble, but I also knew I'd be in trouble, too, if I admitted my accusation was a lie, and that I'd locked Vivian, Natalie, and Allison out of the cabin, and that we'd fought right before they left. So many lies. Each one felt like a rock on my chest, holding me down, so heavy I could barely breathe. I could either admit them and set myself free, or add another one and hope I'd eventually get accustomed to the weight. "Emma," Franny said, this time with more insistence, "do you?" I remained silent. "I see." Franny removed her hand from my back, but not before I felt a tremor stirring in her fingers. They drummed along my spine a moment, then were gone. A few seconds later, Franny was gone, too. She left without saying another word. I spent the rest of the night alone, wide awake in my lower bunk, wondering just what kind of monster I'd become. In the morning, it was Lottie who knocked on Dogwood's door to tell me my parents had arrived to take me home. Since I couldn't sleep, I'd packed hours earlier, transferring the contents of my hickory trunk into my suitcase as dawn broke over the lake. I carried the suitcase out of the cabin and into a camp that had become a ghost town. Silence hung over the empty cabins and darkened buildings, an eerie hush broken only by the sound of my parents' Volvo idling near the mess hall. My mother got out of the car and opened the trunk. She then flashed Lottie an embarrassed smile, as if I had been sent home from a sleepover after wetting my sleeping bag. "Franny apologizes for not being able to say goodbye," Lottie told me, pretending that neither of us knew it was a lie. "She wishes you a safe trip home." In the distance, the front door to the lodge opened up and Theo stepped outside, flanked by two of the detectives who had quickly become a common sight around camp. The firm grip they kept on Theo's elbows made it clear this wasn't a voluntary exit. I stood dumbly by the car and watched as they walked him to the Arts and Crafts building, likely for another interrogation. Theo caught sight of me and gave me a pleading look, silently begging me to intervene. It was my last chance to tell the truth. Instead, I climbed into the Volvo's back seat and said, "Please, Dad, just go." As my father started to drive away, the lodge door gaped open yet again. This time, Chet ran out, his face tear-stained, legs a blur. He sprinted to the Arts and Crafts building, calling out Theo's name. Lottie rushed to intercept him and dragged him back to the lodge, waving to my father to leave before we saw anything else. Yet I continued to watch, turning around in my seat so I could look out the back window. I kept on looking as Lottie, Chet, and the quiet remains of Camp Nightingale faded from view. 32. When Becca leaves, I remain curled up in my bunk, crystals bare in my arms, trying to think of what to do about Lottie. Tell someone else, obviously, but my options are few. Detective Flynn doesn't trust me. I don't trust Franny. And even Theo would have a hard time believing my word over the word of the woman who's been with his family for decades. I stare out the window, weighing my options while watching the evening sky succumb to thick darkness. The search crew in the helicopter has started using a spotlight, sweeping it across the water. When it rumbles overhead every 15 minutes or so, the light brightens the trees outside the cabin window. I'm watching the play of the light and the leaves when there's another knock on the door. It opens a second later, revealing Mindy bearing a tray from the cafeteria. "I brought dinner," she announces. What sits on the tray definitely isn't cafeteria food. This is dinner straight from the lodge. Filet mignon, still swirling with steam, and roasted potatoes seasoned with rosemary. Their scents fill the cabin, making it smell like Thanksgiving. "I'm not hungry," I say, even though under normal circumstances I'd already be devouring the steak. Especially considering how stress and shitty cafeteria food have conspired to keep me from consuming, well, almost anything since I arrived. But I can't even look at the food, let alone eat it. Anxiety has knotted my stomach so tight I worry it might never unravel. "I also brought wine," Mindy says, holding up a bottle of Pinot Noir. "That I'll take." "I get half," Mindy says. "I'm telling you, it's been a day. The campers are terrified, and the rest of us are at our wits' end trying to keep them calm and occupied." She sets the tray on the hickory trunk that was once Allison's and is now Sasha's. Maybe. Or maybe it doesn't belong to anyone anymore. It's like Crystal's teddy bear, temporarily ownerless. From the way Mindy simply plucks the cork from the wine, I can tell the bottle had been opened back in the lodge. Probably to prevent me from having access to a corkscrew. On the tray, I see that the fork and knife are plastic. When Mindy pours the wine, it's into plastic cups. It brings back memories of the mental hospital, where no sharp objects were allowed. "Cheers," Mindy says as she hands me a cup and taps it with her own. "Drink up." That I do, draining the entire cup before coming up for air and asking, "Why the special treatment?" Mindy sits on the edge of Crystal's bed, facing me. "It was Franny's idea. She said you deserved something nice, considering all the stress you've been under. It's been a hard day for all of us, but you especially." I'm assuming there's an ulterior motive. "I think she also thought it might be a good idea for us to share this wine and get comfortable with each other, seeing how I've been ordered to spend the night here." "Why?" I ask. "To keep an eye on you, I guess." There's no need for her to elaborate. No one trusts me. Not when Sasha, Crystal, and Miranda remain missing. I'm still under suspicion until they're found, if they're found. Hence the flimsy knife and plastic cup into which I pour more wine. Mindy watches as I fill it to the brim. "The way I see it, we have two choices here," I say. "We can either ignore each other and sit in silence, or we could chat." "The second one," Mindy says. "I hate too much quiet." It's exactly the answer I expected, which is the reason I gave her the choice, to make it feel like it was her idea to gossip. "How's the mood in the lodge?" I ask. "Is everyone handling it well?" "Of course not. They're worried sick, especially Franny." "What about Lottie?" I say. "She always struck me as a cool customer. I bet that's good in a time of crisis." "I don't know. She seems just as worried as the rest of us." "That doesn't surprise me. I imagine she must be pretty devoted to Franny after working for her all these years."
"You'd think," Mindy says. "But I also get the sense that Lottie considers it just a job, you know? She gets to Franny's penthouse in the morning and leaves in the evening like any employee would do. She gets sick days. She has vacation time. I don't think she's too happy about having to spend the summer here." "Neither am I, but here I am, doing my best to impress Franny."
"And how's that working out for you?"
Mindy pours herself some more wine, filling her cup as high as I did. After taking a hearty sip, she says,
"You don't like me very much, do you?"
You're keeping me here under house arrest, so that would be a definite no. Even before this, when you first got to camp, it's okay to admit it.
I say nothing, which in its own way is an answer.
I knew it. I could tell, Mindy says. I knew girls like you in college, so artsy and open-minded, but so quick to judge people like me. Let me guess, you probably took one look at me and thought I was some spoiled sorority girl who screwed her way into the Harris White family.
Aren't you?
A sorority girl? Yes, and proud of it. Just like I'm proud of the fact that I was pretty enough and charming enough to catch the attention of someone like Chet Harris White.
I'll agree that you're pretty, I say, shedding any pretense of civility. Maybe it's the wine, or the spirit of Vivian lingering in the cabin, encouraging bitchiness.
For the record, Chet pursued me, and it took a lot of convincing. I had no interest in dating the spoiled rich kid.
But aren't you spoiled and rich?
Far from it, Mindy says. I grew up on a farm. Bet you didn't see that coming.
I had assumed she was born privileged. The daughter of a southern attorney, perhaps, or a prominent physician like Natalie was.
It was a dairy farm, she tells me, in middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. Every morning from kindergarten to graduation, I was up before dawn, feeding and milking the cows. I hated every minute of it, but I knew I was smart and I knew I was pretty. Two things women need most to get ahead in this world. I studied hard and socialized and tried my best to pretend that my hands didn't always stink of raw milk and cow manure. And it paid off. Class president, homecoming queen, valedictorian. When I got to Yale, the pretending continued, even after I started dating Chet. Mindy leans back on the bed, swirling the wine in her plastic cup. She crosses her legs, getting comfortable. I think she might already be drunk. I envy her. I was so nervous the first time Chet took me to meet Franny, I thought she'd see right through me, especially when I got out of the car and saw their name on that building. And then the ride in the elevator, all the way up to the top floor? Franny was waiting for us in the greenhouse. Have you seen it?
I have. It's impressive.
It's insane, Mindy says. But the nerves went away when I learned the truth.
She takes a gulp of wine, leaving me hanging.
About what? That they're not nearly as rich as they look. At least not anymore. Franny sold the Harris years ago. All she owns now is the penthouse and Lake Midnight.
That still sounds pretty rich to me.
Oh, it is, Mindy says. But now it's only a few million and not, like, a billion.
How'd Franny lose so much money?
Because of this place.
Even though Mindy looks around Dogwood's tight confines, I know she's referring to what lies beyond it. The camp. The lake, the woods, the girls.
Restoring a bad reputation can get expensive. For Franny, that meant settlements to the families of those missing girls. Chet told me it was at least $10 million each. I guess Franny threw it at them like it was nothing. She did the same thing to a whole bunch of charities, trying to get back in people's good graces. And don't even get me started on Theo.
The accident, I say. Chet mentioned it.
That car he wrecked was chump change compared to what Franny had to spend to get Harvard to take him back. They weren't too keen on inviting an accused killer onto campus. No offense.
I nod, grudgingly respecting Mindy for giving as good as she gets.
None taken. Chet told me Franny had to pay for a new lab building before they'd even consider letting Theo return. I think that's around the same time she sold the Harris. In my opinion, she should have sold this place instead. Chet said he tried talking to her about selling the land around Lake Midnight, but she wouldn't even consider it. So I guess the sale will have to wait.
Mindy cuts herself off before she can let slip that Franny is dying. Even though I already know about the cancer, I admire her discretion. It's nice to see there are some family secrets she's not willing to spill.
Anyway, that's their money situation, she says. Between you and me, I'm relieved.
The thought of all that money scared the hell out of me. Don't get me wrong, there's still plenty. More than my family ever had. But it's less intimidating. The more money there is, the more I feel the need to pretend. Which means I'll keep worrying that my hands still smell like a dairy farm.
Mindy looks down at her hands, turning them over to inspect them in the light of the nightstand lantern.
I'm sorry for judging you, I say. I'm used to it. Just don't tell Chet or Franny or anyone else, please.
I won't.
Thank you. And for the record, I don't think you did anything to those girls. I've seen the way you act around them. You all liked one another, I could tell.
The mention of Miranda, Sasha, and Crystal sends another wave of worry crashing over me. To combat it, I gulp down more wine. I hope they're okay, I say. I need them to be.
I do too.
Mindy drains her cup, sets it on the nightstand, and crawls under Crystal's lumpy covers.
Otherwise, the Harris White name is going to be dragged through the mud again, and I've got a feeling that this time it's going to stick.
33. After the bottle of wine has been emptied and the steak and potatoes have long gone cold, Mindy falls asleep. I don't. Worry, fear, and the prospect of another nighttime visit from Vivian keep me awake. Whenever I close my eyes, I see Sasha's mangled glasses and think of her alone somewhere, stumbling blindly, possibly bleeding. So I keep them open and clutch Crystal's teddy bear to my chest, while listening to Mindy snore on the other side of the room. Every so often, the sound is drowned out by the helicopter taking another pass over the camp. Each time its spotlight sweeps past the cabin means another update on the status of the search. The girls are still missing. It's almost midnight when my phone springs to life in the darkness. Mark is calling, the ringtone loud and insistent in the quiet cabin. Mindy's snoring abruptly stops.
Too loud, she says, still half asleep.
I silence the phone and whisper, sorry, go back to sleep. The phone vibrates in my hand. Mark sent a text.
Found something. Call me.
I wait until Mindy's snoring returns before sliding out of bed and tiptoeing to the door. I grab the doorknob on the verge of twisting it open when I realize that I can't go outside. Not with a camera aimed directly at the door and one of Detective Flynn's minions surely sitting in the lodge's cellar monitoring the live feed. Rather than risk raising all kinds of red flags, I go to the window. Carefully, I take the lantern off the nightstand and place it on Miranda's bed, where I won't trip over it on my way back inside. I then reach across the nightstand and gingerly lift the window first, then its screen. I shoot a glance Mindy's way, making sure she's still asleep, before climbing atop the nightstand and swinging my legs out the window. I twist, the sill pressing into my stomach as I lower myself to the ground. To avoid the camera outside Dogwood completely, I have to cut behind the other cabins on my way to the latrine. I move in a half-crouch, trying not to be noticed by anyone inside the cabins or roaming about outside. The only real threat of being spotted comes from the helicopter and its stupid spotlight, which passes overhead within a minute of my being outside. I throw myself against the wall of the nearest cabin, my back flattened against it, arms at my sides. The spotlight's beam sweeps past me, oblivious to my presence. I don't move until the helicopter skims over the lake. Then I run, sprinting to the latrine, my phone sliding around in my pocket. Inside, I turn on the lights and check each bathroom stall and shower. Just like during my search for the girls this morning, it's empty. Unlike then, I'm relieved to be alone. I make my way to one of the stalls, closing the door and locking it for extra privacy. Then I pull out my phone and call Mark. The connection is weak. When he answers, static stutters into his words.
Billy and found thing.
I check the phone. There's one bar of signal.
Not good at all. I stand atop the toilet seat, holding the phone toward the ceiling, hoping for a better signal. It now shows 2 bars, the second one wavering and unsteady. I stay on the toilet, my body tilted, bent elbow jutting toward the ceiling. It works. The static is gone.
What did you find?
Not much, Mark tells me. Billy says it's hard to research something like a private asylum, especially one so small and remote. He ended up looking everywhere. Books, newspapers, historical records. He had a friend search the library's photo archives and made a few calls to the library at Syracuse. I'm going to email everything he found. Some of it couldn't be scanned because it was too old or in bad condition, but I wrote those down. The sound of rustling paper bursts from the phone, high-pitched and screechy. Billy found a few mentions of a Mr. C. Cutler of Peaceful Valley in the ledger of Hardiman Brothers, a wig company on the Lower East Side. Do any of those names sound familiar?
Charles Cutler, I say. He was the owner. He sold his patients' hair to wig makers.
That's Dickensian, Mark says, and it would explain why the Hardiman brothers paid him $50 on 3 different occasions.
When was this?
Once in 1901, twice in 1902.
That lines up with what I saw in the book Vivian found at the library. There was a picture of the place from 1898.
Did the book mention when it closed? Mark asks.
No. Why?
Because something strange happened after that.
There's more rustling on Mark's end, followed by more static, which makes me worry the signal is again getting worse.
Billy found a newspaper article from 1904. It's about a man named Helmut Schmidt of Yonkers. Does that ring a bell?
Never heard of him.
Well, Helmut was a German immigrant who spent 10 years out west. When he returned to New York, he sought out his sister, Anya.
That name is familiar to me. There was a photograph of someone named Anya tucked into the box I found in the lodge. I even remember her hair color. Flaxen.
Helmut described her as often confused and prone to nervous exasperation, Mark says. We both know what that means.
All too well. Anya suffered from a mental ailment that probably didn't even have a name at the time.
It appears that while Helmut was gone, Anya's condition worsened until she was committed to Blackwell's Island. He looked for her there and was told she had been put into the care of Dr. Cutler and taken to
Peaceful Valley, I say.
Bingo. Which is why Helmut Schmidt then traveled upstate to Peaceful Valley to retrieve his sister. Only he couldn't find it, which is why he spoke to the press about it.
Are you saying it didn't exist?
No, Mark says. I'm saying it vanished.
That word again, vanished. I've grown to hate the sound of it.
How does an insane asylum just disappear? No one knew, or more likely no one cared, Mark says. Especially because the place was in the middle of nowhere. And those who lived even remotely nearby wanted nothing to do with it. All they knew was that it was run by a doctor and his wife, and that the land had been sold a year earlier.
And that's it?
I guess so. Billy couldn't find any follow-up articles about Helmut Schmidt and his sister.
I hear the clatter of keys, followed by a single, sharp click.
I just emailed the files.
My phone vibrates in my hand, an email alert.
Got them, I say. I hope it helps.
Darkness creeps into Mark's voice, the telltale sound of concern.
I'm worried about you, Em. Promise me you'll be careful.
I will.
Pinky swear?
Yes, I say, smiling in spite of all my fear, exhaustion, and worry. Pinky swear. I end the call and check my email. The first item Mark sent is scans of 2 pages from the same book I found in the library. One contains the paragraphs mentioning Peaceful Valley, minus Vivian's pencil mark. The other is the photograph of Charles Cutler, cockily standing in front of his asylum. The next few files are all text, pages from psychology books, psychiatric journals,
a master's thesis that makes a cursory mention of Peaceful Valley, in a section about the history of asylums and progressive treatments. I assume they all served as sources for one another, because the information is almost identical. The final file Mark sent holds an assortment of images scanned from various archives. The first picture is the now familiar one of Charles Cutler outside his domain, although the caption accompanying the photo identifies it only as Peaceful Valley, as if it had been a spa and not an asylum. The second photo is a shot of just the asylum itself, that gothic main building with turret and weather vane, the utilitarian wing jutting out from its side. But it's the third picture that makes my heart thrum like I've just chugged a pot of black coffee. Identified merely as the entrance to Peaceful Valley, it shows a low stone wall broken by a wrought iron gate and ornate archway. They're the same gate and arch I passed through the other day in Theo's truck. The very same ones that now grace Camp Nightingale. The blood freezes in my veins. Peaceful Valley Asylum was here, right on this very piece of land. Which explains why Helmut Schmidt couldn't find it. By the time he came looking for his sister, Buchanan Harris had already turned the area into Lake Midnight. That, I realize, is the information Vivian was looking for. It's why she snuck into the lodge and went to the library. It's why she was so worried about her diary getting into the wrong hands that she rode across the lake to hide it. And it's why she was so scared. Because she learned that there's a ring of truth to the story surrounding Lake Midnight. Only it wasn't a deaf village or a leper colony that got buried beneath the water. It was an insane asylum. 34. Despite the late hour, Camp Nightingale still crawls with cops. They linger in the Arts and Crafts building, visible through the lit windows. More stand outside, chatting as they sip coffee, smoke cigarettes, wait for bad news to arrive. One trooper has a sleepy bloodhound at his feet. Both man and dog lift their heads as I hurry to the lodge. "You need something, sweetheart?" the trooper asks. "Not from you," I say, tacking on a sarcastic, "sweetheart." At the lodge, I pound on the red front door, not even trying to be discreet about my arrival. I want the whole fucking place to know I'm here. The pounding continues for a full minute before the door swings away from my fist, revealing Chet. A lock of hair droops over his bloodshot eyes. He pushes it away and says, "You shouldn't be out of your cabin, Emma." "I don't care." "Where's Mindy?" "Asleep. Where's your mother?" Franny's voice drifts to the door.
"In here, dear. Do you need something?"
I push past Chet into the entrance hall and then the living room. Franny is there, cocooned in her Navajo blanket. The antique weapons on the wall behind her take on new, sinister meaning. The rifles, the knives, the lone spear.
"This is certainly a pleasant surprise," Franny says with faked hospitality. "I suppose you can't sleep either, not with all this unpleasantness."
"We need to talk," I say. Chet joins us in the living room. He touches my shoulder, trying to steer me back to the door. Franny gestures for him to stop.
"About what?" she says.
"Peaceful Valley Asylum. I know it was on this land. Vivian knew it too." It's easy to see why she went looking for it. She'd heard the story about Lake Midnight, possibly from Casey. Like me, she probably considered it nothing more than a campfire tale. But then she found that old box by the water's edge, filled with scissors that rattled like glass. She did some digging, searching the lodge, sneaking off to the library. Eventually, she realized the campfire tale was partially true, and she needed to expose it. I suspect she felt a kinship with those women from the asylum, all of them likely drowned, just like her sister. Keeping that secret must have made Vivian so lonely and scared.
She hinted at it in her diary when referring to Natalie and Allison. The less they know, the better.
Vivian wasn't able to save them. Just like her, they had learned too much after finding her diary. But she had managed to keep me safe. I understand that now. Her mistreatment of me wasn't an act of cruelty, but one of mercy. It was her way of trying to protect me from any danger her discovery created. To save me, she forced me to hate her. It worked.
The only people she told were Natalie and Allison, I say. Then all three of them disappeared. I doubt that was a coincidence.
A dainty china cup and saucer sit in front of Franny, the tea inside steaming. When she reaches for them, the cup rattles against the saucer so violently that she sets it down without taking a sip.
I don't know what you want me to say. You can tell me what happened to that asylum. Something bad, right? And all those poor girls there, they suffered too.
Franny tries to pull the blanket tighter around her, the noticeable tremor still in her hands. Veins pulse under her paper-white skin. She loses her grip, and the blanket drifts to her sides. Chet rushes in and pulls it back over her shoulders.
"That's enough, Emma," he barks. "You need to go back to your cabin."
I ignore him.
I know those women existed. I saw their pictures.
I march to the study, heading straight for the desk and its bottom drawer. I yank it open and see the familiar wooden box right where I had left it. I carry it into the living room and slam it down on the coffee table.
These girls, right here.
I open the box and grab a handful of photos, holding them up so Franny and Chet see their haunted faces.
Charles Cutler made them grow their hair, then he chopped it off and sold it, and then they vanished.
Franny's expression softens, turning from fear to something that resembles pity.
"Oh, Emma, you poor thing. Now I know why you've been so distressed. Just tell me what happened to them."
"Nothing," Franny says. "Nothing at all." I study her face, looking for hints that she's lying. I can't find any.
"I don't understand," I say.
"I think perhaps I should explain." It's Lottie who says it. She emerges from the kitchen, wearing a silk robe over a nightgown. A mug of coffee rests in her hands.
"I think that might be best," Franny says.
Lottie sits down next to her and reaches for the wooden box.
"It just occurred to me, Emma, that you might not know my given name."
"It's not Lottie."
"Dear me, no," Lottie says. "That's just a nickname Franny gave me when I was a little girl. My real name is Charlotte. I was named after my great-grandfather, Charles Cutler."
I falter a moment, buzzing with confusion.
"His mother was insane," Lottie says. "My great-great-grandmother. Charles saw what madness did to her and decided to devote his life to helping others who suffered the same way. First at an asylum in New York City, a terrible place, the women forced to endure horrible conditions. They didn't get better, they only suffered more. So he got the idea to create Peaceful Valley on a large parcel of land owned by my great-grandmother's family. A small private retreat for a dozen women. For his patients, Charles chose the worst cases he observed in that filthy, overcrowded asylum. Mad women, too poor to afford proper care. Alone, no friends, no families. He took them in."
Lottie rifles through the open box, smiling at the photographs as if they were pictures of old friends. She pulls one out and looks at it. On the back, I see the words, "Juliet, Irish Red." From the very beginning, it was a struggle. Even though he and my great-grandmother were the only employees, the asylum required so much money. The patients needed food, clothing, medicine. To make ends meet, he came up with the idea to sell the patients' hair,
With their permission, of course. That kept things afloat for another year or so, but Charles knew Peaceful Valley would eventually have to close. His noble experiment had failed. She pulls out two more photos. Lucille Tawney and Henrietta Golden. But he was a smart man, Emma, Lottie says. In that failure, he saw opportunity. He knew an old friend was looking to buy a large parcel of land for a private retreat. A wealthy lumberman named Buchanan Harris. My great-grandfather offered the land at a discounted price if he was given a position in Mr. Harris's company. That was the start of a relationship between our families that continues today. But what happened to Peaceful Valley? It stayed open while my grandfather went about building the dam that would create Lake Midnight, Franny says. During that time, Charles Cutler found new situations for the women in his care, Lottie adds. None of them returned to those brutal asylums in the city. My great-grandfather made sure of it. He was a good man, Emma. He cared deeply about those women. Which is why I still have their photographs. They're my family's most prized possession. I sway slightly, shocked my legs are still able to support me. They've gone numb, just like the rest of me. I had been so focused on learning Franny's dark secret that I never stopped to consider that Vivian was wrong. So it had nothing to do with what happened to Vivian and the others? Not a thing, Franny says. Then why did you keep it a secret? We didn't, Lottie says. It's no secret, just ancient history, which has been warped over the years. We know the stories campers tell about Lake Midnight, Franny adds. All that hokum about curses, drowned villagers, and ghosts. People always prefer drama over the truth. If Vivian had wanted to know more about it, all she needed to do was ask. I nod, feeling suddenly humiliated. It's just as bad as when Vivian cut me down right before she disappeared. Almost worse. Once again, I've accused someone in the Harris-White family of doing a terrible deed. I'm sorry, I say, knowing that a simple apology isn't nearly adequate. I'm going to go now. Emma, wait, Franny says. Please stay. Have some tea until you feel better. I edge out of the room, unable to accept any more kindness from her. In the entrance hall, I break into a run, fleeing out the front door without closing it behind me. I keep running, past the cops outside the Arts and Crafts building, past the cluster of dark and quiet cabins, all the way to the latrine, where I plan to hop into a shower stall with my clothes still on and pretend I'm not crying tears of shame. I stop when I notice a girl standing just outside the latrine. Her stillness catches my attention. That and her white dress aglow in the moonlight. Vivian. She stands in the woods that encroach upon the camp, just a few feet from the line where the trees end and the grass begins. She says nothing. She only stares. I'm not surprised to see her, not after the day I've had. In fact, I've been expecting it. I don't even reach for the bracelet that's no longer there. This meeting was inevitable. Rather than speak, Vivian merely turns and walks deeper into the forest, the hem of her white dress scraping the underbrush. I start walking, too, not away from the woods, but toward it, pulled along against my will by Vivian's reemergence. I cross the threshold separating camp from forest, the point of no return. Under my feet, leaves crunch and sticks snap. A twig from a nearby tree, as slim and gnarled as a witch's finger, grasps a lock of my hair and gives it a yank. Pain pricks my scalp. Yet I keep walking,
telling myself it's what I need to do, that it's perfectly normal. I'm not going crazy, I whisper. I'm not going crazy. Oh, but I am. Of course I am. 35. I follow Vivian to the sculpture garden, where she sits in the same chair Franny occupied days earlier. The statues around us watch with their blank eyes. Long time no see, Em, Vivian says as I cautiously step between two of the statues. Miss me? I find my voice. It's small and meek and skitters like a mouse across the clearing. You're not real. You have no power over me. Vivian leans back in her chair and crosses her legs, her hands primly folded on her knee. Such a strangely ladylike gesture, especially coming from her. Then why are you here? I didn't ask you to follow me. You're still trailing after me like a lost puppy. Why did you come back? I say. I was doing fine without you. For years. Oh, you mean painting us, then covering us up? Is that the fine you're talking about? If so, I hate to break it to you, girlfriend, but that's not fine. I mean, honestly, vanishing once should have been enough for you. But no, you had to make us do it over and over. I don't do that anymore. I've stopped. You've paused, Vivian says. There's a difference. That's why you're here, isn't it? Because I stopped painting you. It's how I've kept her at bay all these years. Painting her, covering her up, doing it again, then again. Now that I've vowed not to do it anymore, she's returned, demanding my attention. This has nothing to do with me, Vivian says. It's all you, sweetheart. Then why am I only seeing you and not... Natalie and Allison? Vivian lets out a knowing chuckle. Come on, Em. We both know you don't really care about them. That's not true. You barely knew them. Vivian stands, and for a quick, heart-halting moment, I think she's going to reach out and grab me. Instead, she begins to wind her way around the statues, caressing them like lovers. Fingers trickling up arms, palms gliding across throats. I knew them as well as I knew you, I tell her. Really? Did you ever have a conversation with either of them? One-on-one? I did. I know I did. But when I scan my memory, no such recollections appear. Now that I think about it, I'm not sure you even talked to them when I wasn't around, Vivian says. At least not about something other than me. She's right. It's true. That's not my fault, I say. You made sure it was that way. Vivian never wasn't around. She ruled the cabin the same way a queen bee ruled the hive. The rest of us were just drones, buzzing around her, catering to her needs, her whims, her interests. That's why you're not seeing Natalie and Allison right now. Vivian says. I'm the puzzle you're still trying to figure out. Will you go away if I do? Vivian pauses before a sculpture of a woman carrying a jug on her shoulder, her toga slanted across her chest. That depends. Do you want me to go away? Yes, and I hope you never come back. I don't say it. I can't. Not that. So I think it, a mental whisper that floats across the clearing, wispy as fog. But Vivian hears it. I know by the way her lips curl upward in cruel amusement. Now that brings back old times, she says. You certainly got your wish, didn't you? I want to run away, but guilt holds me in place. It's a numbing sensation, a flash freeze. By now, I'm used to it. I've been feeling it on and off for the past 15 years. I'm sorry for saying that. Vivian shrugs. Sure, whatever.
It still doesn't change things between us.
I want to make it right.
Oh, I know. That's why you came back here, right? Trying to find out what happened, snooping around just like I did. As a result, look what happened to your new best friends.
Her mention of the new girls catches me off guard. I spend a millisecond wondering just how she knows about them. Then it dawns on me. She's not real. She has no power over me. I'm stronger than everyone realizes. Strong enough to understand that Vivian isn't a ghost haunting me, nor is she a hallucination. She's me, a fragment of my distressed brain trying to help me figure out what's happening. Which is why I stare her down and say, "You know where they are, don't you? You know where I can find them."
"I can't tell you that."
"Why not?"
"Because I'm not real," Vivian says.
"That's your motto, right? I have no power over you."
"Just tell me."
Vivian moves on to another statue, hugging it from behind, her chin resting on its delicate shoulder.
"Let's play a game, Emma. Two truths and a lie. One, everything you need to know is already in your possession."
"Just tell me where they are."
She shifts to the statue's other shoulder, her head coyly tilted.
"Two, the question isn't where to find them, but where to find us, as in me and Natalie and Allison."
"Vivian, please."
"Three, she says. "As for where we are, that's not my place to say. But I can tell you this. If you find us, maybe, just maybe, I'll go away and never come back."
She slips behind the statue, temporarily eclipsed. I wait for her to pop into view again on the other side. When a minute passes and she doesn't appear, I take a few weak steps toward the statue.
"Vivian," I say.
"Viv?"
There's no answer, nor is there any sign of her presence. I continue my approach, picking up speed on my way to the statue. When I reach it, I peer around its marble shoulder. Nothing is there. Vivian is gone. Yet her parting words remain, hovering in the middle of a clearing like moonlight. Those three statements, two true, one a lie. I have no idea about the first two. Like much of what Vivian said while she was alive, it's hard to tell the difference between what's true and what's false. As for her third statement, I hope it isn't a lie. I want it to be the truth. Every word of it.
36.
I returned to Dogwood the same way I left, zigzagging around the cabins to avoid being spotted. The helicopter seems to have packed it in for the night. So, too, have the search boats. When I get a glimpse of the lake, I see no activity on the water. It's just an empty, black mirror reflecting starlight. But the camera is a different story. I know it remains ever watchful, which is why I slip to the back of the cabin and hoist myself inside through the open window. Mindy's snores tell me she's still asleep. Good. I get to avoid having to explain both where I've been and where I plan on going next. To find the girls. Both sets of them. Vivian's words, my words, haunt me as I crawl down from the nightstand. The question isn't where to find them, but where to find us. Something Miranda said comes back to me. I heard the words as I was free-falling into sleep.
"I'm worried about Emma."
That worry might have led her to action. Brash, confident Miranda, mystery lover and future detective. Like Vivian, leading another set of girls into the woods for answers. Then there's Vivian's toying suggestion that I might finally be rid of her if I find out what happened to the three of them. Maybe she's right. Maybe the only way to free myself from the grip of guilt is to learn the truth. "I hope you never come back."
Christ, I hate myself for saying that, even though I had no way of knowing it would come true. Natalie and Allison were already outside when I uttered those words. Vivian was right in that regard. I really didn't talk to them very much. Something else I regret. I should have paid more attention to them, treated them as individuals and not just part of Vivian's entourage. All the same, I'm grateful they never heard what I said to Vivian, that those weren't my parting words to all of them. I tiptoe across the cabin, careful to avoid that one creaky floorboard. The memory of something else Vivian said fresh in my mind. Everything you need to know is already in your possession. I know what she's referring to. The map. It's why they came back to the cabin, only to discover the door locked. Vivian needed her hand-drawn map to help her find the spot where her diary was hidden. She still thought there was something sinister behind the lake's creation and Peaceful Valley's end. I suspect she was planning to use it to expose whatever she thought she had found out about Franny and the Harris family. I quietly open my trunk and remove my flashlight. Then I reach inside and feel around, searching for the map. It's not there. The girls must have taken it with them, bolstering my theory that they set off to find their predecessors. More hope that I'm right, that I'm not too late. As Mindy keeps on snoring, I take another trip out the window. Soon, I'm rushing headlong through a patch of trees to the edge of the lake. At the water, I make a left, hurrying along the lakeshore to the dock and canoe racks. Atop the slope of lawn, the lodge rises heavy and dark. Only one window is illuminated, second floor, overlooking Lake Midnight. 5 minutes later, I'm out on the lake in a canoe. I row in strong, fast strokes, hoping the helicopter and search boats don't return until I reach the other side. My phone sits in my lap, set to the compass app. I glance at it every few seconds, keeping myself on track, making sure I'm cutting across the lake in a straight line. I know I'm near the far shore when I start to hear eerie scraping along the bottom of the canoe. Underwater tree branches, making their presence known. Flicking on the flashlight, I'm greeted by dozens of dead trees rising from the lake. They're a ghostly gray in the flashlight's beam, the same color as bones. I wedge the flashlight between my neck and shoulder, tilting my head to keep it in place. Then I resume rowing, using the oars to push myself away from the submerged trees, or when a collision is unavoidable, blunt the impact. Soon I'm past the trees and close to the other side of the lake. The flashlight's beam skims the shore, brightening the tall pines there. A pair of deer at the water's edge freeze in the light before stomping away. Gray specks flutter within the beam itself, insects drawn to the light. I steer the boat to the left and row parallel to the shore, flashlight aimed to the land on my right. The beam catches more trees, more bugs, the flap of an owl's wings blurred white. Finally, it illuminates a wooden structure rotted beyond repair. The gazebo. I guide the canoe onto shore and hop out while it's still running aground. I shove my phone back into my pocket and aim the flashlight toward the woods. I breathe deeply, trying to focus, rewinding to that earlier trip and how we got from here to the X marking Vivian's diary. I can't remember how deep into the woods we traveled, or how exactly we found our way there. I sweep the flashlight's beam back and forth over the ground, looking for any footprints we might have left behind. All I see is hard dirt, dead leaves, pine needles dried to splinters. But then the beam catches something that glows dull white. Stepping closer, I see splashes of color. Vibrant yellows, blues, and reds. It's a page from a comic book. Captain America, in all his patriotic heroism, fighting his way through several panels of action. A small rock rests atop the page, keeping it in place. The girls were here. Just recently. The page's placement is no accident. It's their trail of breadcrumbs, marking the way back to the lake and their canoe. I step over the paper, tighten my grip around the flashlight, and, like the girls before me, vanish into the woods. 37. The forest at night isn't silent. Far from it. It's alive with noise as I move deeper through the woods. Crickets screech and frogs belch, competing with the calls of night birds rustling the pines. I fear that other sounds are being drowned out. The footfall in the underbrush, the cracking twig signaling someone is near. Although there's no reason to believe I was followed here, I can't dismiss the idea. I've been watched too much not to be on alert. My flashlight remains aimed at the ground a few feet ahead of me. I sweep it back and forth looking for another page ripped from Crystal's comic book. I spot one where the ground begins to slant upward. It, too, sits beneath a rock, as does another one placed 50 yards ahead. I pass 5 more pages as the incline sharpens. Captain America leading me higher. Another page waits where the land flattens out at the top of the incline. It shows Captain America deflecting bullets with his raised shield. The dialogue bubble by his head reads, "I refuse to give up." I pause long enough to swing the flashlight in a circle, studying my surroundings. The beam brightens the birches around me, making them glow white. To my right are patches of starlight. I'm now atop the ridge, mere yards from the cliff that drops away into the lake. I turn left, approaching the line of boulders that punctuate yet another steep rise. Captain America is there as well, placed atop several boulders, held in place with small rocks. I scramble among them until I reach the massive rock, the monolith. I aim the flashlight up the hill, angling for a better view of the path ahead. There's still no sign of the girls, not even more Captain America. Just more boulders, more trees, more leaf-strewn earth pitched sharply upward. The forest around me continues to hum. I close my eyes, trying to tune out the noise and really listen. That's when I hear something. A dull thud that sounds once, twice. "Girls!" I shout out, the echo of my voice booming back at me. "Is that you?" The forest noise ceases, save for the frightened scatter of some spooked animal fleeing to my left. In that blessed moment of silence, I hear a muted reply. "Emma?" "Miranda. I'm sure of it. And she sounds close, so wonderfully, tantalizingly close." "It's me," I call back. "Where are you?" "The Hobbit House." "We're trapped," someone else says. "Crystal, I think." Miranda adds one more desperate word. "Hurry!" I rush onward, my flashlight gripped in my hand. I leap over tree roots. I dodge boulders. In my haste, I trip over a downed branch and fly forward, landing on my hands and knees. I stay that way and crawl up the incline, my fingers clawing the earth, feet flicking to propel me higher. I don't slow down, not even when the crumbling stone foundation comes into view. Instead, I go faster, climbing back to my feet and running toward the root cellar cut into the earth. At the door, someone has pushed the ancient slide bolt into place, locking the girls inside. A knee-high boulder has been rolled in front of it for good measure. Another thump arrives from inside the root cellar. The door shimmies. "Are you here yet?" Miranda calls. "We need to get the fuck out of here." "In a second." I rap on the door announcing my presence, before giving the slide bolt a mighty shove. It rasps past the door itself, allowing Miranda to open it a crack, before being stopped by the boulder. A thick, sickly odor drifts out, a mix of damp earth, sweat, and urine that makes my stomach roil. Miranda presses her face to the crack. I see one bloodshot eye, a red-rimmed nostril,
her parted lips sucking in fresh air. "Help us," she says with a gasp, giving the door another desperate rattle. "Why aren't you opening it?" "It's still blocked," I say. "I'm working on it. How are Crystal and Sasha?" "Awful. We all..."